Chapter 41. A slow gray drizzle was falling at McChord Air Force Base south of Tacoma when the C-141 lumbered in from its trans-Pacific flight. The big jet's tires screeched on the damp runway before the aircraft rolled to a stop in front of a transit terminal where its engines were shut down and the large rear cargo door lowered to the tarmac. Holding true to his word, Dirk had slept nearly the entire flight and exited the ramp feeling refreshed but hungry. Summer followed behind in a groggier state, having slept unevenly in the noisy aircraft. An air transit lieutenant located the pair and escorted them to the base officers' club for a quick hamburger before returning them to the flight line. Spotting a phone booth, Dirk eagerly dialed a local number.
"Dirk, you're all right," Sarah answered with obvious relief.
"Still kicking," he chimed.
"Captain Birch told me you were aboard the Numa ship that sank in the East China Sea. I've been worried sick about you."
Dirk beamed to himself, then proceeded to tell her an abbreviated version of events since flying to Japan.
"My gosh, the same people that released the cyanide in the Aleutians intend to launch a larger attack?"
"It appears that way. We hope to find out more when we get back to D.C.
"Well, keep your friends at the CDC informed. We have a terrorism emergency response team in place to combat sudden chemical or biological outbreaks."
"You'll be the first one I call. By the way, how's the leg?"
"Fine, though I'm still getting used to these blasted crutches. When are you going to autograph my cast?"
Dirk suddenly noticed Summer waving him towards a small jet parked on the runway. "When I take you to dinner?"
"I'm off to Los Angeles tomorrow for a week-long conference on environmental toxins," she said with disappointment. "It will have to be the following week."
"Consider it a date." Dirk barely had time to sprint to the Gulfstream 5 jet that was warming its engines on the tarmac. Climbing aboard, he was chagrined to find Summer sitting at the center of attention, surrounded by a small group of Pentagon colonels and generals on the jet bound for Andrews Air Force Base. The large executive jet buzzed over the Jefferson Memorial at 6 the next morning en route to landing at the Air Force Base located just southeast of the nation's capital. A Numa van was waiting for the pair and whisked them through the light early morning traffic to the headquarters building, where Rudy Gunn greeted them in his office.
"Thank God you're safe," Gunn gushed. "We were turning Japan upside down looking for you in that cable ship."
"Nice idea, but wrong country," Summer said with a jibe.
"There's some folks here who'd like to hear about your ordeal firsthand," Gunn continued, hardly giving Dirk and Summer a chance to relax. "Let's go to the Admiral's office."
They followed Gunn as he led them around the bay to a large corner office overlooking the Potomac River. Though Admiral Sandecker was no longer the director of Numa, Gunn subconsciously refused to acknowledge the fact. The door to the office was open, and they walked in. Two men were seated at a side couch discussing coastal port security, while Homeland Security Special Assistant Webster sat in a chair across from them, studiously reviewing a file folder.
"Dirk, Summer, you remember Jim Webster from Homeland Security? This is Special Agent Peterson and Special Agent Burroughs with the FBI's Counterterrorism Division," Gunn said, motioning a hand towards the two men on the couch. "They've met with Bob Morgan already and are very interested to know what happened to you after the Sea Rover was sunk." Dirk and Summer settled into a pair of wing-back chairs and proceeded to describe the entire course of events, from their imprisonment on board the Bayekjet to their escape on the Chinese junk. Summer was surprised to note that 3 hours rolled by on an antique ship's clock mounted on the wall by the time they finished their saga. The Homeland Security Administrator, she noted, appeared to turn whiter shades of pale as their report progressed.
"I just can't believe it," he finally muttered. "Every shred of evidence we had pointed to a Japanese conspiracy. Our whole investigative focus has been centered on Japan," he said, shaking his head.
"A well-designed deception," Dirk stated. "Kang is a powerful man with considerable resources at his disposal. His means and abilities should not be underestimated."
"You are certain he aims to target the United States with a biological attack?" asked Peterson.
"That's what he insinuated, and I don't believe he was bluffing.
The incident in the Aleutians would seem to have been a test application of their technology to disperse a bioweapon into the air.
Only now they have boosted the strength of their smallpox virus to a much more virulent form. Not unlike stories I've heard that the Russians may have created a vaccine-resistant strain of smallpox back in the 1990s, Gunn added. Only this one's a chimera, a deadly combination of more than one virus that takes on the lethal elements of each, Summer said. If the strain is immune to our vaccines, an outbreak could kill millions, Peterson muttered, shaking his head. The room fell silent for a moment as the occupants considered the horrifying prospect. The attack in the Aleutian Islands proves that they have the means to disperse the virus. The question becomes, where would they target a strike? Gunn asked. If we can stop them before they have the chance to strike, then it doesn't matter. We should be raiding Kang's palace and his shipyard and his other sham businesses, and we should be raiding them right now, Summer said, slapping a hand on her leg for emphasis. She's right, Dirk said. For all we know, the weapons are still on board the vessel at the Inshan shipyard, and the story can end there. We'll need to assemble more evidence, the Homeland Security man said flatly. The Korean authorities will have to be convinced of the risk before we can assemble a joint investigative force. Gunn quietly cleared his throat. We may be on the verge of providing the necessary evidence, he said, as all eyes shifted his way. Dirk and Summer had the foresight to contact Navy Special Forces before leaving Korea and brief them on Kang's enclosed dock facility at Incheon. We couldn't authorize them to act, but a well-placed call by Rudy got them to at least listen to what we had to say. Summer grinned towards Gunn. It's well beyond that now, Gunn explained. After you and Dirk departed Osan, we formally requested for an underwater special ops reconnaissance mission. Vice President Sandecker went out on a limb to obtain executive approval in hopes we'll be able to locate a smoking gun. Unfortunately, with the ruckus over our military deployment in Korea, it's a sensitive time to be nosing around our allies' backyard. All they need to do is snap a picture of the Baekje sitting at Kang's dock, and we've got proof positive, Dirk said. That would certainly boost our case. When are they going in? Webster asked. Gunn looked at his watch, then mentally calculated the 14-hour time difference between Washington and Seoul. The team will be deployed in about 2 hours. We should know something early this evening. Webster silently gathered his papers, then stood up. I'll be back after dinner for a full debriefing, he grumbled, then made his way towards the door. As he left the room, the others could hear just a single word being muttered repeatedly from his lips as he vanished down the hall. Korea.